Well, now, George Saunders, who won the Man Booker Prize, has quite a few strings to his bow, in fact. Until now, he's been both a short story writer and also a journalist. As a regular contributor to The New Yorker, he covered the Trump trail, for instance. He's particularly interested in what seems like the big challenge of the moment, how to step into others' shoes, politically and culturally, exactly what Danny Wood has been trying to do. In a quite superb New Yorker essay during last year's presidential campaign, he offered an arresting example of two people, say, approaching an imaginary castle. One has only watched Monty Python and the Holy Grail. The other just has watched Game of Thrones. So is there any collective meaning left around the very idea of a castle, he wonders? Where's the common basis for chatting, let alone debate? Empathy and insight into other perspectives are sorely lacking, he suggests. We can feel and see the results of this vacuum around the world, and he's determined to rectify it wherever he can. I spoke to him late yesterday from London, where he was still celebrating. Not a good phone line, I'm afraid, but a charming, constructive man, worth hearing him. I hope you'll agree.
Yes, we are still celebrating. Like 300 people around here, and it's a wild party, but I've asked him to be quiet for a few minutes. So.
Look, I must read to you something that came out this afternoon from one of our better political commentators, Sean Kelly. He said, who could have imagined 8 years ago that George W. Bush would emerge as a rallying point for the American left after he did that big speech earlier today, really lamenting the America he could see? Does it surprise you?
Well, yes, everything, it all surprises me at this point, but you know, I think what it underscores is that there's sort of just a fundamental lack of decency about this administration, and maybe slowly, glacially, people who are, you know, sort of habitually right-wing are starting to be offended by the sheer dysfunction of it all. So that's, it's encouraging, and I hope it continues.
But in your acceptance speech, a little of which was played on our sister program, Books and Arts, you talked about the importance of seeing ambiguity and trying to see the other person's point of view, even when that's hard. Now, I mean, tell me how you worked that out. I mean, and how do you do it?
Well, I'm not that great at it. I'm a big advocate for it, but doing it is a different thing. But I think what I feel is about to happen, I hope, is that the very, very shrill political overlay that Americans have been buying into more and more, I think terribly aggravated by social media, is going to be seen to be inadequate. There's no way that we can politic ourselves out of this mess. So from my point of view as a fiction writer, we have to turn a little more to what I would sort of call the moral, ethical, or the spiritual basis. So in other words, forget politics for a minute. Is it a good thing to be as antagonistic, mutually antagonistic, as we are right now across the parties? Of course not. Is it a good thing to have a leadership that seems to not care about a great number of the people, happy to, you know, sort of rouse this part at the expense of another part? Of course it isn't. As long as we think of it, though, in simplistic political terms, it's only going to get worse. But if we start to say, what do we believe in as moral, ethical beings? What is at least theoretically the basis of this American idea? Then we might be able to get back to some sort of functionality, you know.
Well, in that Monty Python and Game of Thrones example, you went on to say that in previous times, not long ago, a liberal and a conservative, or a dove and a hawk, say, would have got their information from one of, say, three nightly news programs, a local paper, and a handful of national magazines of various sorts. And thus they were starting with the same basic facts, even if some were incorrect. Now, if you don't have that anymore, how are you going to get back to that shared area of mutual respect?
To me, that's the perfect statement of the question. And to be honest, I don't know. The only thing I'm noticing a little bit, I've been kind of touring around the U.S., there seems to be a slight revulsion at the prominence of social media and somewhat of a connection that says, oh, I've been ingesting a toxin, you know, every day for the last, you know, there's actually a toxic sort of effect on one's mind when you indulge in social media. It's actually encourages a different kind of discourse that is less than the actual human discourse we use one-on-one. So also I think a dawning idea that these social media providers are corporations, and they're not they're not neutral providers, and they actually don't care that much about the discourse, although they often claim it's completely free and transparent.
But have you changed your social media use, for instance, as you gradually come to grasp this?
I have. Actually, I've never had much social media. I just have one sort of weekly attended to author page, which now I look at almost never. I'm not on Twitter, and I actually, you know, went to the extreme measure of taking my news feed off of my phone as well as Facebook. And honestly, it's amazing how in those last 2 weeks, I'm a better reader.
Really?
Of books. Yeah, I swear. When we first got on social media, I just couldn't help but notice my reading comprehension and my attention span dropped. And because I was such a late adapter, I could really see it. So I think if you multiply that times 10 million, and then you think about the effect it has on one's peace of mind, you know, we call it virtual because it actually isn't real. It's actually a kind of an invented, projective space that seems real and we think it's real, but you know, if we watch our manners when we're in that space, they're not good, and we would never dream of saying in person the things we say. And
manners? Now, there's a word from the past.
Yeah, that's right. with a capital M, if you don't mind, and my little pinky is listed. You know, but I think it's true. If you imagine, you know, saying some of the things that you hear on the internet, it just wouldn't happen. That's got to have a degrading effect on every part of life, politics, family life, even, you know.
When did you start to notice the coarsening or the decline of public discourse? You comment on this. I just wonder when you first noticed it.
I think I first noticed it, I would have to say it was when, as social media and internet use started to rise. Also, in the States, this Fox News is a huge problem that, again, I think is a little misunderstood. It started to, in my, you know, experience, maybe 15 years ago, Fox News started to become very powerful, and it's become the news of choice for a great, great number of typical Americans. And of course, it skews way right. Its logic is quite bad. Its rhetoric is really, really not very intelligent. But recent studies have shown that it actually, if you take a centrist person and expose her to 8 hours of Fox or 8 hours of the equivalent sort of left-leaning thing, the effect on her politics is more pronounced in the conservative direction. So they've got a kind of a mastery of some kind of propagandistic thing that is just moving the needle. The center is shifting so far right, I wouldn't have been able to imagine it 5 or 10 years ago. So I think that's one of the unknown, or sort of one of the quantities is this constant injection of facile right-wing thought.
But you do write in this very good essay, from the beginning, America has been of two minds about the other. One mind says, be suspicious of it, dominate it, deport it, exploit it, enslave it, kill it as needed. The other mind denies there can be any such thing as the other in the face of the claim that all are created equal. Now, I don't necessarily want a political analysis from you now. It's more that sense of how, say, you, as clearly a very considered, educated man, jumps into the mind of the unlucky and the disenfranchised and the lost, who are the other, I suppose.
Yes. Well, this to me is the entire literary project, is can a person over here of this class and this race and this group imaginatively occupy another person's mind? My working theory is that yes, the human mind is so similar between you and me. It's the same basic structure with some very small, lovely variations between people. It's actually quite possible for me to imagine the experience of another person. If you've been hungry, you can imagine starvation. So that's the basis of literature, and I find it very lovely and invigorating to assume that's the case. And now, this is the tricky thing, it's also true of one's political enemies. And to me, it's a kind of a win-win. If I can imagine the state of mind of a Trump supporter, one, it's a loving act that I think God would want me to do. And second of all, it helps me if my aim is to persuade this person away from the current position. I would argue it actually helps me to have some kind of affection and love for that person, while at the same time not being a pushover and not enabling the the negative behavior.
Dare I say, it still sounds like a theory of yours, it's as opposed to necessarily lived out. I want to ask you...
No, actually, in truth, it is very... When I covered the rallies, there was a lot of... I had a lot of real friendship with the people. Now, the persuasion part is theoretical. That actually doesn't happen. But the experience is something that I think is certainly doable.
Okay. So where are the better angels of America's nature? Because you say there is civility there, but by the sound of you, you've got to search for it.
Yeah, I think actually the center is holding through these, you know, kind of thousands, tens of thousands of small, decent acts that hold the civil society together. From the progressive angle at this moment, I think the challenge is to not despair. And you know, in the absence of some big overarching solution, to forget that society is held together with these small acts of kindness and mutual seeing. You know, and if you say to yourself generally, what should we do about Trump supporters? I don't think there's a satisfactory answer. But if one of them is walking on the sidewalk in front of you and sprains your ankle, you immediately know what to do. So I'm not really despairing, and I think despair right now is the enemy for people who want a decent world.
Mm. Well, I hope you're right. You do sort of tilt at the thought that the whole fragile experiment could be in danger, but it's good to hear you end on an up note. I hope you have a wonderful party. Continue to have it.
Everyone's getting very impatient here to go back to the drinking, so I'll have to let you go.
Oh, you better go then. You better go. Thanks so much. No. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
George Saunders is the author of Lincoln and the Bardo, and I hope you agree, quite a remarkable observer and storyteller despite that line. If you'd like to hear an earlier interview with Mr. Saunders on books and arts with Sarah Konoski, she delves into the craft and the philosophy of his award-winning book. It was a terrific interview. You can download it at any time, but it's also being broadcast again today, Saturday, at 2 o'clock.